Reclaiming Christianity, Episode 2, Flickering Pixels, How Technology Shapes Your Faith. Hey there, guys. This is John Weldy again. I am not going to have any kind of intro music. I'm not going to have any cuts, anything like that. This is just a raw podcast. That's the way it's going to be, because that's just the kind of guy I am. Part of it is because I don't really feel like I need to spend time doing that. So if at some point somebody wants to learn how to do that stuff, the editing and the music and everything like that, I don't mind having a more polished podcast. I never want to have a super polished podcast. That's not my goal because I'm not a super polished person. I mean, my favorite podcast and who I am authentically is somebody who likes to talk things over. I don't like to take a lesson. I remember when I was trying to be somebody in the church. The way you be somebody in the church is by preaching, right? And so I followed the rules for preaching, and I was like, okay, so the preaching, so you got to put together your outline, and you've got to get together exactly what you want to say, and you got to practice it this way, and you got to practice it this way, and you got to practice it with a pastor, and then you got to do this and that. And it's like by the time I actually got it done, it sucked the soul out of it for me. Now, I'm not adverse to rehearsing things. I'm not adverse to doing things myself. I was a part of a drum and bugle corps, which is like a high-level marching band. So basically, I was a professional musician, except professionals get paid. I was a professional musician for two summers of my life, touring around with a 150-member band. And it was great. It was awesome. I experienced high-level stuff, and we worked the snot out of an 11-and-a-half-minute show. So I understand what it means to change and revise, but when it comes to something like a podcast, I want to have personality. A podcast is about voice. All a podcast is voice. And so I want my voice to be heard. And this is really why I'm doing this, too. As I record this, this is actually one day after I recorded my previous one, and it's been quite a day. And I'm the type of person, I have to be excited about something in order to do it, so I'm not sure whether I'm going to, I don't really want to post two episodes of the podcast within 24 hours of each other, so I might wait a little bit and stick it in the can for a little bit, but I need to be excited when I'm doing something. I need to have that passion. Passion really drives me. And so I really want to release who I am through this podcast. I want to release my voice. And the reason why I do this podcast, it's really for me. I do this podcast primarily for me because I can't not do this podcast. It took me a long time to figure that out, that this is what I wanted to do. I spent a lot of time writing little posts and things on Facebook, and some people are trying to get me to write a book, and it's like, I don't really want to write a book. I mean, it feels so commercial. It feels so stilted. It's like, I got to work it. But a podcast, this can be me, because I can be an authentic person, and you can get a sense for my personality, and I can be who I am. And I don't just want to do this podcast. The reason that I don't do any editing and I don't do any music and I don't do all the fancy bells and whistles on the podcast, part of it is because I don't want to, you know, and I want to release who I am. But another part of it is for you, because I want you to do the same thing, because I feel that I have a responsibility. I feel, and this is something that I've felt from my Facebook posts, which have grown a whole lot since I've been going through this process that some of us call deconstruction, of deconstructing the things that I thought I knew about God, faith, the universe, and life, and pulling down some old walls and building up new things and having much more being satisfied with mystery instead of certainty, not having to know all the answers and seeing the beauty in all things. And one of the things that I have learned in that process is I want to help other people find their voice. I want to have a unique voice. I want to be who I am. But I also want to be the voice to other people. I want to be the voice to people who do not have a voice. And there are many, many, many people within Christianity in America who do not have a voice. I mean, we think that we're very fortunate. There's a lot of people that don't have a voice all around the world, people in abject poverty, people in terrible situations. And we don't have as much of that. But we have a pyramid-shaped culture here in America, whether it be in the churches or whether it be in the government or whether it be in entertainment. We have a pyramid-shaped culture. It used to be that if you were into music 100 years ago, it meant that you played an instrument and you sang and you got on your porch and played music and you made music yourself. But with the advent of recording, that all changed because all of a sudden a bunch of people realized, oh, I'm not good enough to do this. No, that's not true. You absolutely are good enough to do this. And that's what I want to show you through this. Because when I say I want to be your voice, I want to be a voice to people that don't have a voice. It doesn't mean that I want to be the one sitting here on this podcast and you listen to me, my good little children. You always listen. No, that's garbage. That's what our culture does. What I want to do is I want to help you find your voice, and I want to help you express your voice, and I want to be an inspiration for you. I don't ever want this podcast to be something that has millions of listeners. I respect some of those big podcasts. I love The Liturgists. I love Pete Enns' podcast. I don't know if they have millions, thousands of listeners. I love Rob Bell's podcast. I love Malcolm Gladwell's podcast. He might have millions. But I don't ever want to be one of those big polished podcasts. I love what they do. That's not me. It's not authentic. I love hearing what they do, but I need to be me. And I want to have a small podcast. And if it grows, I'm fine with it growing, but it doesn't mean that I'm going to change what it is. I'm not going to change the DNA because then I would hate it and I wouldn't do it. And I want to help and empower you to do the very same thing. You can do what I'm doing. I want you to do what I'm doing, and that's part of the reason why I have lower production values for my podcast, because I want you to be doing what I'm doing. I want you to release your unique voice, whether it's in a podcast, whether it's in music, whether it's in art, whether it's in writing, whatever it is, release your unique voice. This is what the medium of a podcast is to me. I mean, I loved writing on Facebook, and I still write a lot on Facebook. Actually, today was the first time in about a week and a half that I got on Facebook. I've been on kind of a Facebook fast for a while, and there were times when I was on a Facebook fast before, when I was in a deeper, more evangelical type religion and really law-based religion. And I was like, oh, you have to fast. You have to do this. You're not supposed to be doing this. Oh, it's Lent. You have to give up something. No, you don't really have to. It's all up to you. You know, but I just felt it was a time that I was so busy. It was between two activities that I really love here in my beautiful city of Indianapolis. And I was just so busy and there were so many voices going on that I just needed some quiet. And honestly, I still need some quiet. And that's part of, see, when you hear the voices coming in from every direction, whether it's Facebook or podcasts, or I love listening to the great courses, there's some amazing stuff on there, some amazing things that you can learn, or movies, I love movies, TV shows, you know, whatever it is. When you listen to so many voices that are around you, you don't have time to develop your own voice. It's good to listen to what other people have to say, but you need to develop your own voice and get it out. And that's why I kind of went on a Facebook fast for a while, but I was back on today because I just launched my podcast, you know, so I was excited about it. And the thing that I got immediately, I had several people that tell me that they were really excited to get my first podcast, and that's really awesome. Some people gave me some really cool feedback, but I also got multiple people that all of a sudden decided that they were going to tell me what I needed to do on my podcast. Now, these are people that love me, and I get that, you know, but it really kind of set me off a little bit that, okay, dude, I just made this thing, and you have no idea. If you haven't done a podcast before, okay, first off, you can do a podcast. You can do a podcast. It's not that I will help you find everything you need. Everything that I found that I needed to do in this podcast, I got in one article, and I signed up for a few different things. And I've got the storage, and it's all a free storage. I had to buy a microphone that hooked up to my laptop, you know. But that's pretty much it. I had to learn a couple things, and it's not really that hard of a thing. But still, when you sit down at the table with a microphone in front of you, and you're ready to hit that record button, your heart go, you're like, boy, I wonder if they can hear my heartbeat through the microphone right now. Because it's like, it's on. It's on. And it's only me. And there's nothing else on this. It's just me. And I'm winging it. And it's a scary thing. And it's especially a scary thing because what this is, whenever you do something that's creative, whether it's a podcast or whether it's writing on Facebook or whether it's writing a book or whether it's visual art or whether it's music, you know, whatever you do that's creative, when you put yourself out there and say, hey, this is the product that I've created, it's a risk because the critics are everywhere. Especially in this society, right? Because we've made our society so that we give 1 through 5 stars to everybody. We do it all the time. We do it for restaurants. And I mean, you know that that's in your head. You know that's in your head since we have that 1 through 5 star rating system. We know we're doing that all the time. I saw an episode of a TV show called Black Mirror. It's a Netflix series that's kind of like Alfred Hitchcock for the technology generation. And it's absolutely a wonderful show. And it actually showed this gal going through her life. And in this world, they had basically their phone built into their eyes and whatnot. And every interaction that they had throughout the day, they gave a rating 1 through 5 stars to. And if you had a high star rating, then you're a more popular person and you get discounts on your housing and thing. And if you're have a low rating, then it's harder for you to rent a car and fly on a plane. It was a fantastic, I highly recommend this. Take a look at this, turn off my podcast for a second, watch this show, Black Mirror on Netflix. It's absolutely wonderful. This is what the episode I'm talking about is season 3, episode 1. And it's the only one that I have memorized like that. The whole show is great, but the season 3, episode 1 especially stood out to me. And really, that's what we do. We're all critics. We cannot know how to play the guitar at all, but we can tell you, oh, that guy missed a note. We all have that critical spirit. And when I say we all, I mean me. I point the finger at me more than anybody. Oh my gosh, I have such a tendency to be a critical person. I definitely, absolutely do. And what I found out, see, I have not really been on this side of it for a long time where I've got something creative that I'm putting out there. And that's really scary. It is to put yourself, because I pour myself into this podcast. I don't pour a bunch of money into this podcast. I don't pour a bunch of knowledge into this podcast. I don't pour a bunch of pedigree into this podcast. What I pour into this podcast is who I am. The person I am on this podcast is the person that I am in real life. Although, I mean, obviously, I'm gonna act better on this podcast than I will in real life sometimes, because sometimes I'm just a jerk. You know, I just plain am, and I know that. And I know that we always want to put our best face, you know, especially Facebook is really good at narcissism. But I am getting beside the point, though. So I've been on the other side, the side that's saying, oh, I see this thing that's created. I see this thing that's being created. I know I can rip that apart. I know this can be better this way, and this can be better this way, and this can be. And I have left some scathing reviews for people on some podcasts that they've created before I even created a podcast myself. And understand, I love doing this. This is fantastic. I mean, I wouldn't be doing it 2 nights in a row if I didn't love it. I think it's amazing. But at the same time, it's scary. It is. When I hit that record button, it's like, it's just me. It's just me now. And so I've forgotten how it can feel to be on the other side, to be on the creator side, seeing people pick apart, even little things, even people that you know love you, that you know have their best interest, but because you didn't solicit any, I mean, I didn't solicit any, hey, give me, tell me what's wrong with my podcast, you know? And so these people are, what they told me, multiple people told me, you know, it really needs to be shorter. It really needs to be shorter, you know, because my first podcast was 68 minutes long, you know, and that's okay. I don't know how long this one's going to be. We'll see, you know, but what's happening there is they're missing the point. Because, I mean, of course I could make it shorter. Of course I could. But that's not my point of what I'm doing. My point of what I'm doing is being myself. And I'm not doing it to get lots and lots of viewers. I mean, if my podcast was 40 minutes instead of 68, maybe I would get a lot more listeners. If I had music on the front of it and I had sections and segments all laid out, this is the bumper for this section, and I've got two co-hosts with me that are professional sure, I'd get more people to listen. But that's not me. That's not who I am. And my podcast, first and foremost, is about who I am. It is about satiating my desire to be known, my desire to express myself. And at the same time, I want to help satiate your desire to express yourself also. So the book that I'm going to read today, I'm going to read a chapter from one of my favorite books. It's by a fellow named Shane Hipps. Shane Hipps was one of the teaching pastors at Mars Hill Bible Church. This is not Mark Driscoll's Mars Hill in Seattle, Washington. This was Rob Bell's Mars Hill in Granville, Michigan. And this guy is a former Mennonite and a former ad executive. In this book is called Flickering Pixels, How Technology Shapes Your Faith. And this has been a very foundational book for me upon what I think about, especially what I think about the church and what the church is and what I think about my educational theory. I have previously been a teacher. Part of that teacher comes out in my podcast. And right now I'm serving as a technology coordinator, and so I don't get to do as much instruction. I don't get to do as much teaching, and so that's part of the reason why I want to do this podcast also, because I know some of that teaching comes out in what I'm doing. And there's so much of my educational theory and my theory on what church is that was shaped by this book. In this book, Shane Hipps is, in addition to being a former Mennonite pastor, he is also a former ad executive. And he talks about a fellow from the 60s that was one of these guys that had books that sold tons and tons of copies, and he went to conferences and got paid tons of money for appearing at conferences and speaking. His name is Marshall McLuhan. And the central focal point of what this guy's teaching was all about is the media is the message. And so what that means, when you are watching a TV show, the content is not the message. You would think, it seems obvious that the content, whatever, whether you're watching Chips, where did I pull that out of? Whether you're watching Chips or whether you're watching Battlestar Galactica or whether you're watching the Animaniacs, you know, that's the message. No. That's not what, I don't know if you can hear that right now, but my cat's freaking out. But he's saying that, no, the content is not the message. The media is the message. So the television itself is the message. So what is the message that is being sent right now by having a box with lights that everybody is sitting around a room watching? And I mean, obviously that leads me to, okay, so what is the message of church? Because most churches, especially in the United States, you know, but most churches all over the world, almost every single church, whether it's a Lutheran church or a Catholic church or an Orthodox church or an evangelical church, just about every single church in the entire world does church the same exact way, almost the same exact way, whereas you have a band playing some kind of music, a band or an organist or hymns, you know, some kind of music you start off with. And most of that, you know, if you have hymns, you'll have a song leader, you know, so there's a few people that everybody is in these rows watching. And then you have one guy, and let's be honest, normally it's one straight white guy, right? Am I right? And everybody has to listen to him. Everybody sits in rows, folds their hands in their lap, has their Bible ready for whatever passage he wants to pull up, and you have to listen to this person. And this is what we spend most of our time doing in church, is sitting in rows and listening to one person. What's the message of that? Forget about the words that one person says, because the media is the message. The message that he's saying to us is not the message. The message is the media itself. And what is the media of church? What is the media of the church worship service? It's that this guy up front, this straight white guy, is very, very important, and you need to listen to him. Right? I mean, I could take that all sorts of different directions, but I'm going to keep it very, very basic and not get really derogatory with it. But that's the message, is that this straight white guy standing in front talking to you for 40 minutes is a very important person, and you need to listen to him. Is that the message that we want to send? So that's really what this book gets into. So I'm going to read from chapter 4, and I'm going to take a drink quick here first. I'm going to read a bit from chapter 4. Chapter 4 is called Dyslexia and Deception. When my daughter Harper was 2, we started singing the ABC song together. In the process, we introduced her to one of the most powerful technologies the world has ever known. It's the one you are consuming right now, the technology of letters, the invention of writing. In a way, teaching her how to read is actually teaching her brain to do something completely unnatural. The skills of walking and talking arrived intuitively over time, but reading and writing forced her brain to operate in a way that was not innate. She had to learn to compress reality into line after line of strange shapes arranged in sequence. Such a technology takes work to master, and when mastered, completely transforms our consciousness. I don't take the medium of writing for granted. As a second grader, I remember being tortured by in-class reading tests. I had to use every last brain cell to decipher the words and sentences on the page. After straining through the first couple of sentences, I would inevitably notice that the two kids on either side had already flipped to the next page, while I was stuck on the first paragraph. As panic would set in, I started turning the page whenever they did so I wouldn't look dumb or slow. It seemed like a good plan at the time. Of course, we were often quizzed on the material we had just read, or in my case, not read. And needless to say, I did not score well. Fortunately, in short order, my teachers and parents caught on. I was eventually tested for learning disabilities and diagnosed with dyslexia, a condition often caricatured as reading words backwards. My dyslexia is a bit more subtle. Every time I look at the printed page, I feel like I've just walked out of a dark movie theater into the bright light of day. It takes time for my eyes to adjust and begin cobbling together the letters on the page into something that makes sense. My difficulties with reading and writing didn't just affect my schoolwork. Dyslexia actually makes my brain function differently than the brains of others. In those early diagnostic tests, I also scored very low on both visual perception and the ability to organize information or objects. This is common for kids who have dyslexia. Reading and writing demand the visual organization of objects, in this case, letters. That meant that in addition to my reading difficulties, my desk at school was a hopeless mess, a black hole for most of my homework assignments. In contrast, those without difficulty reading had no trouble with visual perception and could organize information and objects with ease. Whether they chose to be organized was a different matter. The point is, they had a competence that I did not. At the same time, compared to normal readers, I scored extremely high in the area of short-term memory. This phenomenon is not uncommon among children with dyslexia or other reading problems. The explanation is quite simple. Like a blind person who develops acute hearing for survival, my brain compensated for my visual deficits by enhancing memory, specifically auditory memory. Because I could barely access information through the visual act of reading, I depended upon retaining what the teacher said for my learning. Incidentally, as I have become more fluent in the world of literacy, my organizational skills have improved and my short-term memory has diminished. My wife could attest to this fact. The fact that I didn't read or write much made me a very different kind of thinker, a different person, actually. What was true for me on an individual level is true on a cultural level, too. The broad introduction of literacy into an entire culture completely alters the way that culture thinks. Writing restructures the worldview of entire civilizations. So I want to stop here for just a second. And if you haven't heard my podcast before, this is the second episode, obviously. But if you haven't heard my podcast before, or maybe I'm 15 episodes in by the time you're listening to this. And you're coming back to hear, oh man, I've got to hear all the episodes because he's amazing. But I'm going to stop in the middle of the book. I don't read the book straight through. So basically, what I say this podcast is book reviews and commentary. And so this is the commentary part. I started off with a commentary part. I will tell you a little secret about the book reviews. I'm going to give the book review right here. I absolutely love it. I adore this book. This is one of my favorite books. In fact, every book that I read on this podcast is going to be an amazing book that I absolutely love. I'm not going to give you any books that are crap. because I'm not going to give any books that are crap. I am a person that loves dealing with passion, and I have to deal with what I'm passionate about. If you send me a book and you say, hey, I want you to read this on your podcast, and if I don't like the book, I'm not going to read it on my podcast. That's just the way that it is. I'm sorry, Jack. But but I talked in the previous podcast about history. So many of us in the church, especially in the evangelical church, know nothing about church history. Our church history goes from Genesis to Revelation and then my church. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. It's so helpful to know church history. Now, this book, we're not going to talk specifically about church history, but in a way, it is going to get into church history because he's going to start talking about the printing press and how that affected our faith. And this is a marvelous book, How Technology Shapes Your Faith. Well, the chapter that I'm going to read is The Technology of the Printing Press, How That Has Shaped Our Faith. Next heading is called We Become What We Behold. We're told that we are what we eat, with some exceptions. When most of us eat a lot of fatty foods, we get fat. But there is one expression that's true for everyone. We become what we behold. That is to say, our thinking patterns actually mirror the things we use to think with. Most of us are aware of some basic cultural differences that exist between cultures of the East and the West. But what may surprise us is that many of these differences are a direct result of something as simple as the alphabet. The Chinese use a pictographic or ideographic alphabet, while the West uses a phonetic alphabet. In Chinese, a single character represents an entire word or concept and often looks a little bit like the thing that it describes. For example, see if you can guess what the following Chinese character represents. So there's a picture in the book right here, and I think this chapter, this is the only picture that there is, but there's a picture right here, and the character looks like somebody running. This character actually translates as woman. It looks like a stick figure, basically. And you can see the hints of a human form, but beyond simply depicting the shape of a stick figure, this particular character traces the subtle attributes of feminine energy. You can see beauty, curves, and movement in the character, almost like it's dancing. This is a visual art form, not just a writing system. In contrast, our phonetic alphabet uses symbols that correspond to a meaningless phoneme or vocal sound rather than an idea or object. The symbol T corresponds to the sound T at the beginning of the word top. Taken by itself, T is meaningless. Yet when the symbols are arranged sequentially to recreate the sound of the spoken words, they gain meaning. Unlike Chinese, the English word woman looks nothing like a woman. It merely indicates and creates the sound of the word. The phonetic alphabet requires letters be organized in linear sequence in order to generate meaning. The symbols A, O, M, W, and N don't mean anything until they are arranged as W-O-M-A-N, woman. By contrast, a single Chinese symbol can stand alone and carry full meaning. In a basic sense, the phonetic alphabet is linear, sequential, and abstract. The Chinese alphabet is holistic, intuitive, and more concrete. Because we become what we behold, the East and the West begin thinking in different ways that mirror their respective alphabets. The Western way of thinking, introduced by the Greeks, who perfected the phonetic alphabet, is based on something called a syllogism. A syllogism is simply a linear, sequential thought pattern. Books like this are full of them, but here's a simple example. All humans have a brain. All men are human. Therefore, all men have a brain. You may take issue with the conclusion of this syllogism, but the point is that it mirrors the linear, sequential form of the Western alphabet. This is different from the way Eastern thought generally works. For example, Eastern philosophy is basically non-linear and holistic. There is a simple image that shows this approach to thinking called the yin-yang. So hopefully, it's got a picture of the yin-yang here. Hopefully you know what that is. It's the circle that's divided into two parts, the light and the dark with swirls, and then there's a little light in the dark and a little dark in the light. The image represents the unity of opposites, or the oneness of polarities. Dark and light, heaven and earth, good and evil, feminine and masculine, these are all opposing things that also somehow exist as an indivisible and complementary whole. This way of thinking mirrors the holistic, intuitive characters that make up the Eastern alphabet. The tools we use to think actually shape the way we think. The same applies to our faith as well. The efficient gospel. The printing press had been in existence in China for nearly 800 years prior to its European debut in the 1400s. And yet, did you get that? There's so many of us that don't know that. First off, we don't really know, a lot of us don't really remember, at least, that the printing press didn't come into Europe until the 1400s. But did you really know? Some people listening to this did. I didn't know before reading this that the printing press existed in the 600s in China. The printing press had been in existence in China for nearly 800 years prior to its European debut in the 1400s, and yet it had none of the same liberating intellectual effects that it had in the West. The simple explanation is efficiency. The Chinese language just wasn't very efficient. Because each symbol in the Chinese language represents an entire word or idea, a dizzying number of characters are required for communication. In fact, that number could be equal to the number of words in the language. The Chinese dictionary has more than 80,000 characters and is still growing. The idea of using the printing press for mass communication in China made about as much sense as creating a computer keyboard with 80,000 keys. In this sense, the most breathtaking achievement of the phonetic alphabet is its remarkable efficiency. Only 26 symbols are needed for endless communication. An infinite number of thoughts can be expressed simply by arranging and rearranging these 26 shapes. The invention of the phonetic alphabet helped shape Western thought, but its true force became apparent only after it was channeled through the medium of print. In the 15th century, Johannes Gutenberg found an innovative use for a wine press, and the modern age of the printing press was born. Three media ingredients, paper, printing, and the alphabet, combined to ignite an explosion of nuclear proportions. In Gutenberg's printing press, the phonetic alphabet was given a megaphone to amplify its reach. Printing made writing perfectly uniform and infinitely repeatable. For over four centuries, the printing press made the printed word the standard way of communicating and learning in the Western world. The printing press was the first assembly line, the archetype for nearly every kind of mechanization that followed. This efficient, linear, sequential form of visual organization helped make possible the Industrial Revolution and the subsequent methods of mass production used to make everything from minivans to milkshakes. The linear arrangement of pews in churches did not exist before the printing press. Okay, we just went to a whole different place. So think about that a little bit. Think about that. Pews in churches, the way that they're arranged linearly, that didn't exist before we had a printing press. That's how our language completely shaped the way that we do church. That's 500 years ago. That's not very long ago. The linear arrangement of pews in churches didn't exist before the printing press. The medieval church didn't have pews, just a wide open space for standing. After the printing press, church seating started to mirror the page of a book. So if you think about what a page of a book likes, with orderly text all in a row, that's exactly what a line of pews looks like as well. The impact of the printed medium is nearly endless. It not only led to a restructuring of physical space, isn't that blowing your mind? You never thought of that idea, did you? That's why I love this book. The impact of the printed medium is nearly endless. It not only led to a restructuring of physical space, it restructured our imagination and beliefs as well. This mass production placed information into the hands of everyone, which created the conditions that launched the Protestant Reformation. It even reshaped the gospel. The values of efficiency and linear sequence, which became more entrenched in the Western world with each passing decade, changed the way the gospel was conceived. Under the force of the printed word, the gospel message was efficiently compressed into a linear sequential formula. Apologize for your sins, plus believe Jesus, equals go to heaven. The printing press itself boiled down the gospel into a mathematical formula. Now, if you want to see what some of this looks like, I mean, because we have a hard time imagining, because, I mean, if you're like me, I grew up in the church, and I have a hard time imagining something that I haven't experienced. So, and I mean, when I went and experienced Catholicism, and I experienced Lutheranism, and I experienced some other Christian churches, and I've experienced other religions also, Hinduism and Buddhism and Sikhism, Muslims. But if you really want to see this in the context of a Christian church, Since we're talking about Western Christianity, most of the churches that we have are Western, but there's one called the Eastern Orthodox Church. Go find an East. There's probably, unless you live in a really small area, there's probably an Eastern Orthodox Church someplace in your area. Go visit them one Sunday and see how they do things differently. Now, to the Eastern Orthodox, they are trying to recapture the way that the apostles originally worshiped. Now, whether they actually are doing that or whether they're not, I mean, they'll absolutely tell you that they are, that they're getting as close to the way that the apostles worshiped, the original apostles in the first century worship, as they can. But you can see things that are like, did the apostles really do that? Oh, I'm not going to debate about that. That's not. But what I am saying is, this is a completely different way of doing things than we do in the Western churches and in the Catholic churches and the Protestant churches. So if you want to see a different way of doing things and get outside of your comfort zone, but yet still be within Christianity, I highly recommend take a look at an Eastern Orthodox church, and you'll really get a different spin on things. And some of this stuff that he's talking about in the book, the Western influence on Christianity, some of it will not be there because it's an Eastern influence. Now, some of it still will be there because obviously Western influence is around the globe right now. Back to the text. Such a stunning compression of the gospel. So we're talking about this mathematical formula: apologize for your sins plus believe in Jesus equals go to heaven. Such a stunning compression of the gospel would not have been possible prior to the age of the printed word. Medieval cathedrals told the stories of the Bible in elaborate stained glass windows, in pictures, similar to the Chinese characters. They represented the seeker with a vast array of vague impressions representing the grand sweep of the biblical narrative. The message was far from distilled, but this new abstract linear formulation gained ascendancy in a culture that increasingly communicated via the abstract linear nature of the printed word. This incredible reduction and synthesis of the gospel eventually became a cornerstone for the modern evangelical expression of faith. We become what we behold. Beware of your feelings. The Apostle Paul was a highly literate man, and his letters reflect the kind of abstract, if-then reasoning characteristic of a highly literate, educated mind. During the Middle Ages, before the invention of the printing press, the letters of Paul were seldom taught, because their complex messages could not be captured in stained glass scenes or illustrated prayer books. Most of the Bible is stories. Look back at the Bible, flip open to any given page, there's story after story after story after story. This is because it came to us through oral culture. Paul came through written culture, directly through written culture first, you know, and so Paul is different, the writings of Paul. As a medium, stained glass windows are only able to represent iconic stories like those found in the Gospels. Jesus healed, wept, ate, died, and rose again, but they are hard-pressed to articulate the dense theological reasoning of Paul's letters. The printing press not only resuscitated the letters of Paul, it also helped cultivate the reasoning skills necessary in culture to comprehend his message. This is one reason why Martin Luther's rediscovery of Paul's letters resonated with print culture in a way it couldn't have before that point. So Paul's culture, Paul's letters at this time, because they didn't fit in the culture, they didn't fit in the pictorial culture, Paul's letters were kind of fell asleep. I mean, they existed in the first century, but then they kind of, I mean, the common man didn't know much about Paul's letters because they didn't really fit into the paradigm. They didn't work as stories. We didn't understand them. It's hard. If you don't know much about linear thought, you know, and most of the people in throughout the Middle Ages, from the second until the 16th century, were completely illiterate. You know, and so the common person could not understand the writings of Paul, didn't have any kind of often no formal education, you know. So really, the writings of Paul, except to a small cultured elite, kind of ceased to exist. But when Martin Luther was able to pull it back out through the Protestant Reformation, because empowered by the printing press, all of a sudden the letters of Paul are like the most important thing. You know, and I mean, look at evangelicalism. You know, this is the tradition that I'm from. In evangelicalism, we have the Romans Road. Using one of Paul's letters, this is the way of salvation. Now, if you believe that way, of course. Okay, back to the text. Problems arose, however, when linear reasoning was pushed to the extreme. The medium reversed, as all media eventually do when overextended. Linear reasoning became the primary means of understanding and propagating faith. This led to a belief that the gospel could be established and received only through reason and fact. Printing makes us prefer cognitive modes of processing, while at the same time atrophying our appreciation for mysticism, intuition, and emotion. It can even make us suspicious of or fearful of feelings, especially as they interact with our logical faith. The print age preference for linear reasoning and suspicions of feelings is well illustrated by the Four Spiritual Laws, an evangelistic tract by the late Bill Bright. In this pamphlet, Bright laid out the syllogism of four abstract propositions one must believe in order to be saved. The doctrines must be accepted through reason. Then, in your mind, you move Jesus from the category of man to the category of God. It's this logical, linear process. You check the boxes, 1, 2, 3, 4, boom, you're saved. That's how it works. That's what we've turned it into, right? And honestly, this is the disconnect that I had for so many years, and it just didn't make sense. And one of the things that's really changed in me, the trigger to my transformation over the past few years is an experience of the divine, an experiential knowledge, not a head knowledge, but actually being able to experience something of the divine. And what he's talking about with mysticism, I am greatly, greatly influenced by mysticism right now, by the mystics, who are the first people that are really referred to as mystics in the Christian tradition were the Desert Fathers. So talking Christian history here for just a moment, in I think it was 312, Constantine, basically, between the first and the beginning of the fourth century, Christians were persecuted very heavily because they were seen as a sect of Judaism, and the Jews weren't treated very well by the Romans. Obviously, the whole world was run by the Romans, and the Jews were not treated by the Romans, and so the Christians were treated badly by the Romans. Plus, they were treated badly by the Jews because, I mean, the Romans saw them all as the same thing. The Jews are like, you're not us. You're heretics. You're going off, you know. And so, because of Nero, the Christians got blamed for the fire, the great fire. Nero was a freaking psychopath. I hope you know that. The Roman Emperor Nero in the early second century, I think. I don't know my dates specifically, but I think at the early second century, he was a freaking psychopath. And you know, he's the one that quote unquote fiddled while Rome burned. I mean, the way that we see history, I mean, history is heavily influenced by who won because they were able to control the documents. But the way we see history is that probably Nero set the fire. But he couldn't let people know that, obviously, you know, because Nero wanted to redo the whole city of Rome. And so he wanted to rebuild it in his image. And he couldn't do that without destroying what was there already. And nobody would let him destroy what was there already. He was emperor, but, you know, he doesn't have all the power. There's a Senate and whatnot. And so he probably set the fire. And so he needed a scapegoat for who really set the fire. And so Christians set the fire. And so the Christian persecution, boom, really, really took off at that time. And it lasted up until the fourth century when Constantine converted to Christianity and saw Christianity as this tool that could be used to unify the empire because the Roman Empire was very split up at that time. And so what is better to unify the empire than God? I mean, we have this picture, the Romans had this picture that Caesar is God. Well, Caesar wasn't doing so hot at that time. And so Constantine used the Christian God as a means to unify the empire. It's like, you're a Christian, you're a Christian, you're a Christian, okay? And so the Desert Fathers, where they come into this, this was a group of people. These were the first mystics. This was a group of people that said, we can't get into bed with empire. We see that this is wrong. This is going to taint everything. It's not going to be, oh my goodness, what's ringing? I don't want that to ring right now. Stop that. Stop that. Stop ringing. I gotta pause this. Okay, I'm sorry about that. So I'd say that's, so I've got at least one edit in this right now. So Constantine blamed the Christians. And so the Desert Fathers were like, we know that Christianity is getting into bed with the empire, and we cannot be a part of this. So the reason they're called the Desert Fathers is they went off to live alone. They said, we can't be a part of culture anymore because culture is dragging down the purity of what Christianity is. I mean, I'm talking about them then. That has nothing to do with us now, right? We don't have any tainting of Christianity in our culture right now, do we? Yeah. So this was the start of monasticism. This was the start of monks, monasteries. And it's these men that went to live out by themselves. Some of them lived in caves. Some of them just lived on the outskirts of town, and they came into town to do certain things and still interacted in some way with society. But they lived a more pure form, a more experiential form. And if you see, this is something that we don't really have so much in Protestantism. But we really need to, the Protestants really, we really need to learn from the Catholics about this mystic form of faith. One of my favorite authors is Thomas Merton, who was a mystic author, a monk that was at a Trappist monastery in Kentucky in the early 20th century. He died around 1965, something like that. And he is just a very, very prolific author. He wrote so many wonderful things. I mean, really, if you pick up any kind of collection of Thomas Merton's writings, it's actually absolutely wonderful. And that kind of mysticism is what I've really connected with. And that's what he's talking about here, is that with the advent of the printing press, when we got this logic, when we got A plus B equals C Christianity, we lost a lot of that mysticism. Back to the text. I'm going to go back to the top of the page here where he's talking about the four spiritual laws. The print age preference for linear reasoning and suspicion of feelings is well illustrated by the four spiritual laws. An evangelistic tract by the late Bill Bright. In this pamphlet, Bright laid out the syllogism of four abstract propositions one must believe in order to be saved. The doctrines must be accepted through reason. Then, in your mind, you move Jesus from the category of man to the category of God. Once you've done this, Bright issues a stark warning under the heading, "Do not depend on feelings." What follows is a well-known train diagram and subsequent explanation. Notice that the linear sequential arrangement of the diagram directly mirrors the form of the printed words. In this diagram, the engine says fact. The coal cart that powers the engine says faith. And then what it's pulled is feeling. According to Bright, the train will run with or without a caboose. Feeling is the caboose. However, it would be useless to attempt to pull the train with the caboose. In the same way, as Christians, we do not depend on feelings or emotions, but we place our reason, trust in God's promises given to us in His printed word. I just read these things right now, and I'm about to retch. I love logic. I'm a very logical, orderly guy. That's who God made me to be. But when I see faith that is boiled down to just logic, you can't do that. It doesn't work that way. This is pretty typical of the print mind. The exaltation of reason is the great legacy of the print age. Printing helped fund the rapid acceleration of higher order thinking and intellectual development. What an extraordinary gift that was to us. However, when it reverses, the print mind tends to devalue the heart. Emotions are seen as pesky little distractions that get in the way of good reasoning. The consequence is that people are reduced to merely cognitive, rational beings. The problem is we are not just rational beings. The Psalms reveal a very different picture. These are the poems of the heart, and they show us that the emotional life is integral to our very being and life with God. But there is another reason that the demotion of emotions is a problem. Our emotions are powerful governors of behavior and are not easily dismissed or denied. Trying to ignore an emotion by putting it at the back of the train doesn't actually work. Eventually, it will halt the train and start pulling in the other direction. Bury an emotion and it often resurrects in the form of something more meddlesome. It might masquerade as something else, like an addiction to food, sex, abusive relationships, or power. The heart does not take kindly to being ignored or restrained. But perhaps the most damaging effect of suppressing the heart is that it deadens desire. that deep longing for life, love, and God fades. Instead, we come to expect less from life. We acquire the bland taste of a domesticated God who resides somewhere in our head. But our head is not home for the divine. The head helps us understand the divine from a safe distance. This is a powerful and valuable enterprise, to be sure, but there is a difference between knowing about God and knowing God. Knowing God comes through direct experience. This experience blooms in a wide-open heart, where desire burns fiercely and freely. In this way, desire is the path to experiencing God. Desire in all its forms, even our dark desires, the ones we're most fearful and ashamed of, the ones we call sin, even those desires are merely disfigured drives searching for the divine in counterfeit form. If we pay attention to them, own them, and push beneath them by peeling back layer upon layer of desire, we eventually find our original desire, the deepest longing that leads us home. So that's the end of the chapter. I don't think anybody else is going to call me here. So I'm going to wrap up here. So the book, once again, is Flickering Pixels, How Technology Shapes Your Faith by Shane Hipps, H-I-P-P-S. And I highly recommend you if this is interesting to you, pick up a copy of this book. I love this book. It has shaped me for an absolute long time. I probably need to give it a rating because I'm officially a review podcast. I give it 5 stars out of 5 stars. I'll give everything 5 stars out of 5 stars. Everything that I read on here, at least. It's such a transformational book that really helps you see how your faith is shaped, because it goes into, I mean, we talk about the printing press here, but then he'll go into print media, and he goes into screens, he goes into radio, he goes into television, movies, video games, he goes into the cell phone, the internet, and all these things, how they shape our faith. It's just an absolutely fantastic book. Shane Hipps is one of my favorite thinkers. And it's very accessible also. The entire book is only about, I think it's only about 150 pages, 180 pages, you know, so it's not a terribly long book either. You can pick it up on Amazon. It's an older book. It came out, well, I say older. It came out in 2009, so it's almost 10 years old right now. So you're probably not going to find it at your local Christian bookstore, or you're not going to find it at Barnes & Noble, but I'm sure you can pick it up on Amazon. So I'm going to sign off right now. Thank you guys for listening. I really appreciate it. And once again, the whole reason that I do this, the media is the message. This podcast, I don't want this to be just about me talking at you. This is why I do a podcast instead of doing Facebook. Facebook is cool. Facebook has some interaction to it, but there's you can't see people in Facebook. You can't hear people. It's not personal in any way. Now I can't see you. I can interact with you through other forms, and I hope you join with me on Facebook, or we can talk. Send me a personal message. My name is John Weldy. Just look for me on Facebook and whatnot. I would love to connect with you in any way that we can. But the reason that I like doing a podcast as opposed to just Facebook is because it's more personal. It's like the difference between sending somebody a letter or actually posting a public letter in a magazine and giving a phone call to somebody. You know, there's a lot more of my personality that comes out in my voice than there is in the printed word. The printed word is fun, but man, you can misconstrue what people are saying in the printed word a whole bunch, right? Okay, so I'm going to sign off right now. Until next time, I'm John Weldy, and I'm just a guy.